At sundowner time, Isaac brought Elsa Pignatelli a seething, tulip-shaped glass of Dom Perignon from a freshly opened bottle without being ordered to do so. He knew all the foibles of each of their regular clients. While they sat in the half-circle round the campfire, keeping above the drift of blue smoke, Sean called his two trackers to the evening conference. This ritual was mainly for the benefit of the client, for everything of importance had been discussed previously and well out of earshot. However, the average client, and especially the first-timers, were impressed by the flow of Swahili between Sean and his trackers. In addition, being included in the ritual gave them a sense of being part of the hunt, and not merely excess baggage. The trackers, both of whom had been with Sean since he had been an apprentice in Kenya, at the time of the Mau Mau Rebellion, were natural actors, and hammed it up splendidly. They squatted respectfully on either side of Sean's camp chair and called him Bwana Mkubwa, or Big Chief. They mimed the animals they were discussing and drew their spoor in the dust between their feet and rolled their eyes and shook their heads, then hawked and spat in the fire for emphasis. They were an oddly assorted pair. One was a tall, taciturn Samburu with shaved head and classical nilotic features, Maria Theresa silver dollars set in the enlarged lobes of his ears. The other was a gnome with a puckish face and bright beady eyes. Matatu was one of the few surviving members of the forest Indorobo tribe, a people famous for their magical bushcraft, adepts of forest lore who had unfortunately been unable to withstand the impact of progress which had destroyed their forests and contaminated them with all civilization's ailments and diseases, from tuberculosis to alcoholism and venereal disease. Sean had named him Matatu, or Number Three, because his tribal name was not pronounceable, and because he was the third tracker whom Sean had hired. The other two had not lasted longer than a week each. Matatu had been with Sean more than half Sean's lifetime. Matatu said, "Ngwe," and rolled his eyes as he drew the perfect imprint of a leopard's spoor in the dust. Sean questioned him in sonorous Swahili, to which Matatu replied in his piping lyrical voice, and at the end spat explosively in the fire. Sean turned to Elsa Pignatelli to translate. "A week ago I hanged five leopard baits, two on the river and the others along the rim overlooking the national park." Elsa nodded. She knew the area well from her previous trips. "We had one strike a few days ago, an old tabby that came out of the park. She only fed once and then left it, and we tracked her back into the park. Since then it has been quiet." Sean turned back and asked Matatu another question. The little Ndorobo answered at length, obviously enjoying the attention. "Matatu checked the baits today while I was fetching you from Salisbury. You're in luck, Signora. We have had another strike on one of the river baits. Matatu says it's a good tom. He ate well last night. The impala bait has been hanging for a week, and even with the cool weather it's ripened nicely. If he feeds again tonight, then we'll sit up for him tomorrow evening."
"See," Elsa nodded. "That is good.
Tomorrow morning we can check the bait and shoot a few more impala, just in case we need them. Then after lunch we'll have an hour's lie down, and then we'll go into the hide around 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon."
"You check the bait? You shoot the impala?"
Elsa told him. "Tomorrow morning I have a meeting to attend." She smiled at Shaza in the chair beside her.
"We have much to discuss."
The discussion took up most of the morning. Gary had made the arrangements with deceptive simplicity. He had sent Isabella off in the Toyota with Sean to check the leopard baits, and had then ordered Isaac and his staff to set up three chairs and a folding table under a masasa tree at the edge of the glade, but well away from the camp itself. Under the masasa tree, the three of them, Gary, Shaza, and Elsa Pignatelli, were as secure from eavesdropping as at any spot on the planet. It was bizarre, Shaza thought, to be discussing such a terrifying subject in such tranquil and beautiful surroundings. On the other hand, the negotiations did not follow the course that either Shaza or Gary had hoped for. Although Elsa Pignatelli had with her a handsome pigskin attaché case, it remained locked and unopened while they delicately circled around the central issue. Almost immediately it became obvious that Elsa had not yet made up her mind to proceed with the Syndex 25 enterprise. On the contrary, she was obviously having serious doubts and misgivings, and would need a great deal of persuasion.
It is a hideous thing to let loose in the world, she said at one point. My relief when NATO rescinded the original contract, ordered us to allow the existing stocks to degrade and to dismantle the plant, was immense. I cannot imagine what possessed me even to consider equipping another plant, especially one over which I would have no direct control.
All that morning Shaza and Gary worked to allay her fears. They tried to devise between them some arrangements that would satisfy her demands on control and the ultimate rules of engagement under which Syndex could ever be used.
If you were to begin manufacturing, any NATO expert who ever inspected the plant and analyzed a sample of the gas would know immediately where the technology was obtained, she pointed out.
If that happened, and it was tracked back to Pignatelli. She did not finish the sentence, but merely spread those long, graceful hands in an expressive Italian gesture. Gradually, as the discussion continued, Elsa moved round in her chair to face Shaza. She began to direct all her remarks and questions to him alone. It was subtly, almost subconsciously, that she excluded Gary from the exchanges. Beneath his bluff exterior, Gary was an intuitive and sensitive negotiator. Before even they realized it, he had detected the currents that ran between these two. He recognized that, belonging to the same generation and the same caste, they shared values and understood a special code that he could not comprehend. He sensed that Elsa Pignatelli wanted to be reassured not by him, but by the man to whom she was inexorably being drawn. Tactfully, he withdrew into silence and watched them fall in love with each other, without realizing what was happening to them. The hum of the engine of the returning Toyota startled them. Shaza glanced at his watch with disbelief. Good gracious, it's lunchtime already, and we've settled nothing.
We have 2 weeks in which to talk, Elsa pointed out, and rose to her feet. We can pick up again from here tomorrow morning.
As the three of them came back into the boma, Sean was already at the bar mixing Pimm's number one in a crystal jug. He prided himself on his personal recipe. "Good news, Signora," he called. "Can I wheedle you into a festive Pimm's?" She smiled a refusal.
"I will have my usual Badois with a slice of lemon. Now tell me the good news."
The leopard fed again last night. Judging by the sign, he came in early, half an hour before sunset. So he's starting to get careless and bold, and he's huge. He's got paws on him like snowshoes.
Thank you, Sean. You always find good cats for me, but never so soon. This is the first day of safari.
Take a nap after lunch, just to settle your nerves, and we'll go into the hide round 3 this afternoon. Isaac offered Elsa her mineral water on a silver tray, and then distributed the tall glasses of Pimm's to the musical accompaniment of tinkling ice. And Sean gave them a toast. To a big old Tom Leopard, death at the base of the tree. The professional hunter's horror was the cat down from the tree and waiting wounded in the tall grass. They all drank the toast, and immediately afterwards Shaza and Elsa fell into a quiet but intent conversation that excluded the younger Courtneys. Gary seized on the opportunity to take his elder brother's arm and gently lead him out of earshot.
"Well, how are you feeling, Sean?" he asked.
"Fine, never better."
Sean was puzzled by this uncustomary brotherly concern. "You don't look fine to me," Gary shook his head. "In fact, it's fairly obvious that you're sickening for a go of malaria. And those ribs!
What sort of crap is this?" Sean was getting annoyed. "There's nothing wrong with my ribs that a couple of codeine won't fix."
"You won't be able to hunt with Signora Pignatelli this evening."
"The hell I won't. I've set up this cap, and he's a beaut.
You will stay in your tent this evening with a bottle of chloroquine tablets beside your bed, and if anybody asks, you have a temperature of 104 in the shade. Listen, big shot, you've screwed up my elephant already. You're not going to do the same with my leopard."
"Pater will hunt with the client," Gary said firmly. "You are staying in camp."
"Pater?" Sean stared at him for a moment before he started to grin. "The randy old dog. Pater has the hots for the widow, has he?"
"Why do you always make it sound so vulgar?" Gary asked mildly. "We are trying to do business with Signora Pignatelli, and Pater needs to develop the relationship to a point of mutual trust. And that's all there is to it."
And when those two geriatric nymphos mess up the leopard, old Sean will be the one who has to go in and clean it up.
You told me that Signor Pignatelli never misses, and Pater is as good a hunter as you any day. Besides which, you aren't frightened of a wounded leopard. Not the fearless Sean Courtney, surely not.
Sean scowled at the jibe and then bit back his response.
I'll go and set it up for them, he agreed, and then smiled.
To answer your question, no, Gary, I'm not frightened of a wounded leopard.
Or of anything else. Bear that in mind, old son.
Shaza lay stretched out on his camp bed with a book. The safari camp was one of the few places in his existence where he had the opportunity to read for pleasure rather than for business or political necessity. He was reading Alan Moorhead's Blue Nile for the fourth time, and savouring every word of it, when Gary popped his head into the tent.
We've got a little problem, Pater. Sean's having a little go of malaria.
Shaza sat up and dropped the book with alarm.
Well, how bad?
He knew that Sean never took malarial suppressants, such as Paludrin or Malaprim. Sean preferred to build up his immunity to the disease and only treated symptoms. Shaza knew also that there had recently appeared along the Zambezi a new strain of P. falciparum that was resistant to the usual drugs and which had a dangerous tendency to mutate into the cerebral and pernicious form.
I should go to him.
No, don't worry. It's responding to the chloroquine already, and he's asleep, so you shouldn't disturb him. Shaza looked relieved, and Gary went on smoothly. But somebody will have to hunt with Signora Pignatelli this evening, and you have more experience than I do.
The hide was in the lower branches of a wild ebony tree, only 10 feet above ground level. Sean had raised it not to protect the hunter, for a leopard could climb and be in the tree with him before he drew breath, but rather to provide a wider field of view across the narrow stream to the bait tree. Sean had chosen the bait tree with infinite care, and Shaza nodded approval as he surveyed it. Most important, it was above the prevailing easterly evening breeze, so the hunter's scent would be wafted away. Also, it was surrounded by dense shoulder-high riverine bush that would give the leopard confidence in his approach. The main trunk leant out over the riverbed at a slight angle, to give the cat an easy climb to the horizontal branch 20 feet above the ground from which the carcass of the impala antelope was suspended by a short length of chain. The foliage of the ebony tree was dense and green. That would also give the leopard confidence to climb. However, the horizontal branch was open, with a window of blue sky beyond it which would silhouette the leopard as he stretched out and reached down to pull the stinking bait up to him. The hide was exactly 65 yards from the bait tree. Sean had measured it with the builder's tape, while earlier that afternoon Elsa Pignatelli had sighted and fired her rifle at the marked range behind the main camp. Shaza had set up the target at precisely 65 yards, and she had put 3 shots into the bullseye, forming a perfect cloverleaf pattern with the 3 bullet holes slightly overlapping each other. The hide was built of mapani poles and thatch, and was a comfortable little treehouse. Inside were 2 camp chairs facing the firing apertures in the thatch wall. Matatu and the Samburu tracker laid out blankets and sleeping bags, a tucker box with snacks, and a thermos filled with hot coffee. Their vigil could last until the dawn, so they were provided with a powerful flashlight that drew power from a 12-volt car battery, a handheld 2-way radio to communicate with the trackers, and even a china chamber pot with a tasteful floral pattern to allow them to last out the night without discomfort. When Matatu had set up the furnishing of the hide to his satisfaction, he scrambled down the ladder, and he and Shaza had a last brief conference beside the Toyota.
"I think that he will come before dark," Matatu said in Swahili. "He is a cheeky devil, and he gorges like a pig. I think he will be hungry tonight, and he will not be able to withstand his greed."
"If he does not come, we will wait through until the dawn. Do not return here until I call you on the radio. Go in peace now, Matatu."
"Stay in peace, Bwana. Let us pray that the Memsab kills cleanly. I do not want this spotted devil to feast on my liver."
The trackers waited until the hunters had climbed into the hide and settled down before they drove the Toyota away. They would park on the crest of the valley 2 miles distant and wait for the sound of gunfire or the call on the two-way radio. Sean and Elsa sat side by side in the two camp chairs. Their elbows were almost but not quite touching. The sleeping bags were spread over the chair backs, ready to draw over their shoulders when the temperature began to drop. There were rugs over their laps. Both of them wore leather jackets, some protection not only against the cold but also against sharp curling claws in an emergency.